As a high school teacher for over 20 years, you generally saw the same students every day. And the students would go to the same classes, see the same rooms. They feel trapped in a brick and mortar building. So they tend to get bored with the same old thing day after day. So you can't teach unless there's what we call teachable moments. So you've got to engage their interest. So I would tell them stories to keep up their interest for encouragement. And I told so many stories so often that students couldn't help but wonder if they were true. And so to make sure that I didn't duplicate myself in telling the stories, I would ask, appoint a recorder in the room with a spiral bound notebook, and I'd say, just whenever I tell a story, just jot it down, and you're in charge of making sure I don't tell the same one twice to the same one over and over again. Because we all know old men like to repeat their stories and tell them over and over again. I wanted to avoid that. And so and then put down the date and time and the essence of the story. And then once in a while, students get excited about or bored, and they would say, please, Mr. Martins, tell us a story. Well, I generally am not short on stories. And sometimes they just wanted to delay something, maybe get out of a scheduled test. But generally the story I would tell was together with that day's lesson. How could that tie into it, that day's lesson? One example would be if I was telling an early American history story and about George Washington, I would call him Uncle George. And they would look at me, how old are you anyway? My friend Tom Jefferson, and so forth. So I would tell the nature of those stories. Well, today I want to tell a story and relate it to a particular subject that's in the Bible. And this one is a story about a person with whom you have some familiarity, if you have any familiarity at all with the Bible. And that would be with a person named Joseph. Now, there's a number of Josephs in the Bible. And each one of them is a remarkable story in itself. There's Joseph, the husband of Mary, who was present at the birth of Jesus Christ, raised the Jesus as his son. There was another Joseph. Joseph of Arimathea, and he was present at the time of the death of Jesus Christ, and he offered to provide then Jesus with a tomb, a burial tomb. I want to cover the life of yet another Joseph, a third one. We call him a biblical patriarch, the 11th son of Jacob, the grandson of Isaac, great-grandson of Abraham. I don't want to look at the stages of Joseph's life and see how each stage of life holds lessons for us. When I was 15, my parents thought it would be a good idea that I went to summer camp. And so I had my first plane ride, and I got on a plane in Minnesota and flew to Colorado. And I went 2 weeks to a summer camp at Manitou Springs at the foot of Pikes Peak, real close to the Garden of God. A Garden of the Gods is the park. And the director of the camp there had it wasn't a church-affiliated one, but it was a religiously affiliated. And he said, if you want to remember the life of Joseph, just remember the three P's. Well, he had my attention. I know the alphabet, three P's. He said, when Joseph was young, they threw him in a pit. Then he went off to Egypt, and he was wound up in Potiphar's house, off to Pharaoh's, and then he went to prison, Pharaoh's court, and then he wound up in a pine box. You know, I'm going, oh, these are the P's, a number of P's. Well, today I want to look at eight P's that are memory points of life for Joseph to give us an understanding of how this Joseph is a precursor model of the life of Jesus Christ. Well, so all of eight memory points here are going to start with the letter P. And the first one I came up was parents. We can't pick our parents, and neither could Joseph. If we turn to Genesis 29, The story of Joseph goes back to when his father Jacob fled from Jacob's twin brother Esau and went to the uncle Laban's house in a far land. And it's an uncomfortable story. If we read in Genesis 29, in many ways, it's a heart-rending story of love, betrayal, and difficult circumstances. And if we go down to Genesis 29 and verse 6, and while Jacob was there, he met and became enamored with a young woman named Rachel. And we've all heard stories about how Jacob worked 7 years before Rachel's father would allow them to be married. And it was a romantic story with intrigue. You can see he was motivated to work hard for 7 years, prepare for a bride. And then there was the wedding feast. But the morning after the feast, Jacob woke up and realized he was married to the wrong sister. He was married to the older sister, Leah. And that had to be a fine howdy-do right there. The scriptures do not spell out the details. So I can only speculate, and I would call it speculation, that Jacob's senses might have been dulled by the partying done at the wedding feast, that and, of course, the veil. And so I'm also going to speculate that Leah was more than a willing participant in this because she was the older sister, and in that culture, you don't marry the younger sister till the older sister's married off first. And so that was the cultural issue there. And Leah had remained unmarried for the entire 7-year betrothal of Jacob's to Rachel. And of course, as we know that, their father Laban says, oh, well, if that's the case, you just serve me another 7 years and you can have the other sister for wife. Gulp. Well, that's not exactly the romantic way to start a relationship, but that's reality. The second P, about the life of Joseph. I mean, that's his father. Father was Jacob. The second P is in Genesis 30. And these are the unusual circumstances of the pregnancy that resulted in the birth of Joseph. Now, in Genesis 30, we read about Jacob and Leah. Leah, the first wife, had 6 sons and a daughter, at least one named daughter. The Bible often doesn't name all of the daughters. So we know that there was at least one daughter. And Rachel, the second wife, was barren. She didn't have any children for many, many years. Well, and if we look in elsewhere in the Bible, we hear about women who are barren that have prayed heartily and then and were healed of that barrenness and then had children. And I'm thinking of the birth of Samuel and his mother, Hannah. If we look in Genesis 32 and verse 22, by the time Joseph then was born of his mother Rachel, Jacob already had many children, and by then he himself was now an older-than-average father. so the circumstances of the pregnancy caused him to be a much younger brother. The third P that I have down for Joseph's life, as I put the preeminent son. He was a favorite son. Well, it was a long time in coming with Jacob and Rachel. And normally, and according to inheritance laws, Jacob's eldest son with Leah would be Reuben, would be the inheritor of Jacob's estate. It's called the law of primogeniture, and therefore the firstborn would have the primary inheritance. And historically, that's standard in many cultures, where the firstborn would have an inheritance, and in some places, some cultures, the oldest inherits everything. That happened with my great-grandfather when his parents, ironically, his father was named Joseph, in West Prussia, in Europe. And Joseph, that Joseph, Martins, had a son, and unfortunately his wife died. Well, he couldn't raise a little boy himself, so he married a second time. And they were married for many years, and he had a second son. And unfortunately, the second wife died. He remarried a third time and had a third son. And when that little boy was two, he died. So who inherits the estate? You have three sons, three mothers, and it was the oldest son inherits the estate, everything. The other two sons are on their own. Historically, what many of them did is they would go into the military. They would, some of them would go, if they were Roman Catholic, they would go into the priesthood. They had other options. But the eldest son would be the inherited one. In the case of the Martins background, there were two Martins brothers that didn't inherit. So one went to Brazil and one went to America. And I'm the result of the one that went to America. But I can say that that Joseph and West Prussia's third wife was named Mary, so I'm a descendant of Joseph and Mary. goes back a ways. But if we look here, Joseph, and normally Reuben would have been the firstborn of the family, but he disqualified himself as the primary inheritor. And Joseph then was the firstborn son of the second wife, so he became then the primary inheritor. And this alone would make him a very special son and would cause him to be disliked or hated by his, indeed, older brothers. And we can read on about in Genesis 37 and thereafter about his father made him a coat of many colors. You know how hard it is to find lots of different colors in that society? It takes a lot of effort, time, and money to be able to do that and to fabricate that up and to make a coat. But it was a designation. It was very special. Well, of course, the brothers were upset by this thought that the young upstart would be preeminent among them, would be the potential inheritor. And then Joseph, if we read on, Joseph told about his brothers about his dreams, basically how his brothers were forecast to all be bowing down to him. Now, I'm not going to go through all those verses, but this couldn't go over well. Can you imagine the little brother telling the big brother that, you know, someday you're going to bow and kiss my ring and, you know, and the things that go with that. So the brothers had an idea. They decided, hey, we're going to get rid of this trouble causer. We're going to move him along. So while he was out one day with them visiting the brothers who were shepherds, they threw him in a pit. A pit means he couldn't get out on his own. It's a hole in the ground, presumably a limestone pit in that part of the world. And they kept him there. So what would you do if you're stuck in a pit? You can't get out. Couldn't do much. So what did Joseph's brothers do? They sold him to their cousins, a second cousin, the Ishmaelites. These were traders, on their camels, and they were heading to Egypt. Great way to get rid of the little naughty little brother in their mind. So they sold him, made a few bucks off the deal, but they kept the coat of many colors. And so... and off Joseph went as a slave to Egypt. And they showed their father, well, wild animal must have got him. They put some spilled blood on the coat. Too bad, so sad. Well, he's gone. They weren't crying, but the father was very upset. We go on to Genesis 37, and we go in verses 5 through 36. What happened when Joseph got to Egypt? They sold him to a fellow named Potiphar. Now, Potiphar was obviously a well-to-do fellow. But this circumstance was, he turned out to be a very valuable helper or slave or servant, as it were, in Potiphar's house. And so he rapidly, because Potiphar found that he was a good decision maker, he could solve problems, and he put him in charge of Potiphar's household. And Potiphar's wife, really took a liking to young Joseph. And she wanted him to commit adultery with her and grabbed him by the coat and said, come with me, my husband is gone. And he knew that was wrong, so he left in a hurry, but she held on to the coat. Now, so that he couldn't ruin her reputation, as it were, she told the husband, Potiphar, when he got home, "The rat tried to rape me, and here's his coat." And I escaped, and Potiphar didn't exactly believe in his wife, because that would have been the death penalty. So he did agree to throw him in prison. So Joseph went off to prison. So we go from Potiphar's house to prison. If we read then in Genesis 39, we read a story about Joseph's life in prison. Now, I don't know how you imagine life in prison to be. I'm suspecting it's not a well-balanced diet with friendly people serving your every need. I'm going to suspect that it's uncomfortable and rats are crawling around and other environmental problems and unsavory people. And while he's in prison, if we read in Genesis 39, he had acquaintances. And acquaintances, one of them was one of Pharaoh's wine taster and another was Pharaoh's baker. Well, what do they have to talk about all day? What are you in here for? Well, what are you in here for? Kind of thing. So they're asking each other why they are in prison. And the wine taster and Pharaoh's baker were bemoaning that they were in prison. And they're all, of course, claiming innocence. But and then we move on to, there was a time that Joseph then predicted. He said, "You'll get out. You will be freed. And when you get out, please remember me." And when the baker was freed from prison and he went back to Pharaoh's court, he said nothing about Joseph. And the wine taster, when he got out of prison, he remembered Joseph. And the Pharaoh then had dreams. And they said, "Oh, we know a guy that can interpret dreams. He correctly interpreted our dreams and said we could, that we could escape." And so the Pharaoh said, "That sounds like a guy I need to talk to, because I need somebody to interpret my dreams." And so Joseph then was called upon to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. Well, Pharaoh learned to trust Joseph at that point and said, "You know what? You need to come work for me." Just like Potiphar wanted Joseph to work for him, Pharaoh said, "You know what? You need to come and work for me." And Joseph ranked up very high in Pharaoh's palace. And basically, in chapter Genesis 41, Joseph was set in charge of the governmental affairs in Egypt. And he was even put in charge of Pharaoh's household. The Pharaoh trusted him with everything. Now, can you imagine trusting when you're probably one of the wealthiest people in the known world and you have somebody you can actually trust, and this is a foreigner who's not going to stick a knife in your neck while you're sleeping? I mean, this is a big responsibility, a huge amount of trust. And so you have this from Potiphar's house to Pharaoh's palace and the amount of trust that Joseph has there. And you say, well, why even have all of this story? So what does it matter? But Joseph was placed in Egypt for such a time, a future time, as was critical for the children of Israel. Jacob's name was changed to Israel. And so they were suffering a severe famine, meaning not enough to eat. And so they said, where do they have food to eat? And that would be in Egypt. Now, the reason they have food in Egypt, even during a famine, even if it doesn't, because it doesn't rain in Egypt much, if ever, is the water comes from the mountains and comes down the Nile River. And it floods every year for the rain in the mountains. And then there's irrigation. And so there's always food to eat in Egypt because they irrigate from the river. And so the Israelites said, let's go to Egypt. There's plenty to eat there. And we can come back when the famine is over. Well, if we recognize then that Joseph was there, kind of an advanced standing person, he was placed ahead of time to help the children, soon to be the tribe of Israel, to survive and even indeed thrive. And if we read on then, ultimately, then the children of Israel did grow. And by the time they left Egypt, the statisticians, the math people said, there could be up to 2 million Israelites after those many years in Egypt. And Moses came, of course, and led them out. And if we take a look, I'm going to turn to Genesis 49 here, because there came a time when Joseph, I'll flip to it. When Joseph knew that he was not an Egyptian native, and he requested that he be buried back in the land of his fathers, where his ancestors were. And so that was his last wish. and if we turn to Genesis 49 and verse 26, verse 26 through 33, it talks about the blessings. And the blessings will be on the head of Joseph, the crown of the head of him who was separated from his brothers. And if we read down verse 29, then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave which is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron and the Hittite as a possession for a burial place. And there they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. They buried Isaac and Rebekah. And there, Jacob said, there I buried Leah. And so when it talks about this was the land of the ancestors of Joseph. And then, and if we read the last verse in chapter 49, that he breathed his last. So it was a matter of Jacob wanted to go back and be buried with his ancestors. And in chapter 50, and we look in verse 5, my father made me swear, saying, behold, I'm dying in my grave, which I dug for myself in the land of Canaan. Therefore, you shall bury me. Please, now let me go up and bury my father, and I'll come back. This is Joseph talking to Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said, go up and bury your father. Joseph went to bury his father and went with him the servants of Pharaoh. In other words, going to make sure he comes back. He's not just going to run off. And it was a very great gathering, verse 9 and so forth. So, verse 20, let's see, chapter 50. And so Joseph likewise wanted to follow in the family footsteps. I'm sure in here, it's in here somewhere. And so in verse 26, here we go, verse 25. And Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. This is from Egypt. Verse 26, Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. And, of course, as we read on and find it, they carried that with them through the Israel all the way back to be buried with his ancestors. So when I put that down for easy memory, they put him in a coffin. I put just a 0.8 was pine box. Okay, easy to build, a time-honored place. So now let's take a look. So what? So what does all this matter? Why is this even in the Bible? Well, just as Joseph was sent ahead by God to protect and preserve the brethren and the future generations of the children of Israel, so was Jesus the Christ sent to earth to protect and preserve his spiritual brethren, the spiritual children of Israel. So I want to take a look at some of the parallels between the life of Joseph and the life of Jesus Christ. First of all, the parents. Remember the eight P's we looked at? The patriarch Joseph's parents came together in an unusual manner, and so were Christ's parents especially selected. In fact, if we read in Matthew 1, verse 19, Joseph of Nazareth was a just-minded man. He didn't put away his future wife when they found out she was pregnant, when she explained she was pregnant of the Holy Spirit. If we read Matthew 1, 19, we read, or Luke 1, 28, Mary was also selected, specially selected to be the mother of Jesus. So we're given this special selection process. The second P that's in Joseph's life, as well as Jesus, and that is pregnancy. Christ, Jesus the Christ, was a result of a miraculous pregnancy. Not expected. Wow, you know, this is could never happen. We read that in Matthew 1, verses 18 through 21. So it was a miraculous or very unusual pregnancy. The third characteristic of Joseph and Jesus was the right of primogeniture, the preeminent son. Well, Jesus was the firstborn of many brethren with the right of primogeniture. And we know that if we look at Romans 8:29, I'm not going to go through all of these for time, Colossians 1:15, Colossians 1:18, Matthew 3:17. But Joseph inherited that same position, being the firstborn of Rachel and the inheritor. Now, although Jesus Christ is the firstborn of our spiritual brethren, we are all of the favorite of God, and he wishes that we would all come to him and that none would perish. We read in Hebrews 12:23. And followed up in 2 Peter 3:8, 3:9. So we can be part of that firstborn because the church of the firstborn, the church of God, is described as part of that inheritance. Then there's the pit. Joseph thrown in the pit. A hopeless situation. Couldn't get out of that pit. And so what did Jesus Christ, what happened to him? He was in a seemingly hopeless situation as a baby, just as an infant when he was what? Just a toddler. And King Herod said, you know what? I'm going to slay every child under 2 years of age just to make sure I got the potential to overthrow him. And so can you imagine nobody your age? Because they're all slaughtered. And that's what happened in Israel at that time. When King Herod in Matthew 2, verses 13 through 24, which reminds me of the movie that you may have seen maybe 30 years ago, I don't know, called Enemy of the State. He's on the run. Nowhere to hide, nowhere to go. Being followed somewhere. And of course, for a short time, they fled to Egypt to escape the sword of Herod. The fifth, so that's being in the pit in a bad situation. The fifth characteristic of Joseph was in Potiphar's house. Now, Potiphar's house for Joseph was a difficult situation because he was put in a place here where he had responsibilities. And we read about in Luke 4, verses 1 through 13, that he was falsely accused, but he left his coat behind. Okay. In other words, there was a piece of evidence that made him look guilty and could have cost him his life, but he was thrown into prison. Jesus Christ was also tempted, as it were, and similarly resisted temptation. We read about in Luke 4 about the temptations in the wilderness. and Satan's many temptations. So the sixth characteristic of Joseph was thrown into prison. Well, Jesus has demonstrated that we can escape the evils of the world by following God's law and living the right way of life. Joseph somehow did well, even in prison. Even though he wasn't immediately rescued, he was in prison for years. Not a comforting thought, to be in prison for years. But Jesus Christ has demonstrated there is a way by following him. The seventh characteristic in Pharaoh's palace, just as Joseph was sent ahead to prepare a safe place for his brethren, so is Jesus the Christ preparing a place for us in John 14:2 and 14:3. And then, interestingly enough, when Joseph was 30 years old, he was released from prison to join Pharaoh's government in Genesis 41, verse 46. Why 30 years old? Well, he was old enough, he was mature enough, respected enough. And then what happened to Jesus Christ when he was age 30? We read in Luke 3, verse 23, he began his public ministry at age 30. So there's that similarity there. Now, the eighth characteristic, and I have written down, is the pine box, where Joseph knew that someday he would be returned to the land of his fathers, the promised land. We read that in Hebrews 11, verse 22, where Joseph was called one of the faithful. Well, we also then have the ultimate hope and destiny to join our spiritual older brother, Jesus the Christ, to join him in the family of God. And it's only by the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is salvation possible and assured. Now, if we take a look at Joseph, the precursor model of the life of Jesus Christ, the parallels are there about parents, unusual parentage, extremely unusual pregnancy. The preeminent son had the right of primogeniture, thrown into a pit of despair. Then Joseph went to Potiphar's house, a place of temptation, and then he was cast into prison, an instant throwing into prison. Then off to responsibility in Pharaoh's court, and ultimately then to the grave in the pine box. So we have these parallels between the life of Joseph and the life of Jesus the Christ. So in that way, Joseph became the precursor model that we can look at and to see how people were primed or prepared for the eventual Jesus Christ. So if you want to remember the life of Joseph, which letter of the alphabet would you focus on? I found it easy to remember the letter P. And so we can go down the line. The easy one, the short version that I learned at age 15, was the pit, Potiphar's house, prison, Pharaoh's court, and pine box. Okay, don't even have to look at my notes to remember those. And then I decorated a little bit with the unusual parents, unusual pregnancy, and so forth, and the law of primogeniture. So if we take a look at the Bible stories that are there, those stories are there for a purpose. We don't always look at the stories and see the underlying outline as to why they're there. But if we look deeply at them, there's usually a coordinated reason that they are there. So let's give every time we see one of these stories, and I know we all like stories, is to what is the underlying value, the underlying meaning of them.